Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Welcome to this week's episode of the TLS podcast. I'm Alex Clark and Lucy Dallas, our arts editor, is here with me. Hello, Lucy.
Hi, Alex. How are you doing?
Well, I'm doing okay. How are you doing? Good Easter?
Yes, very nice. Thank you. Though my whole week wasn't as, It wasn't as lucky as you in terms of your betting triumph.
Well, you say that. And see, the betting triumph, for listeners who weren't with us last week, impossible to imagine, but I won on the Grand National at 66-1, if you please, on a complete fluke. So much as one should never chase good luck, I then reinvested a tiny, tiny bit of that money in the Irish Grand National, which was yesterday, and fell flat on my face. So there we are. That's my life as a gambler over, I think. On another note, the horse, my lucky horse, Noble Yates, was in fact paraded around the car park of the Lord Bagnall Inn in Lachlan Bridge, which is not very far from where I live. So he is very much the local hero and had his turn around the neighbourhood.
Did you go and see him in the car park?
I did not. Because I only read about it in the Kilkenny People the day after. But I know. I would have given him the best carrot I could find because he's a very, very good boy. But I have to say my flirtation with the world of the turf, I think, may have come to an end. I think it's time for me to, as they say, cash out.
Well, that's very, very apropos. And I'm afraid I brought it up with an ulterior motive because we are actually going to talk about gambling later, aren't we? And not the fun side of it, I'm afraid.
No, absolutely not. We'll be joined by Nat Segnett to discuss a trio of books about gambling, from the industry that reels you in to the personal cost of addiction and also the cosmic lure of playing the odds. And then we have Kerin Brazil, who will be taking us into the world of the mysterious and vicious They, as we take a look at the reissue of a 1970s novel with disturbing parallels to the here and now.
But first, we are going to take a look into the world of gambling, harmless for most of us, where we can have a flutter if we want to and enjoy it, as Alex did, without consequences. But for some people, of course, it becomes an addiction and a life ruiner with all the damage, collateral and otherwise, that this entails. This week, Nat Segnett has reviewed three books on gambling for us from three rather different viewpoints, and we're very happy that he's here with us today to talk us through this complicated world. Nat, many thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Let's start with Rob Davis's book, Jackpot, How Gambling Conquered Britain, which is a bold title. He's taking a legal and political and societal look, if I understand it right, at how gambling works, isn't he? And you start your piece by explaining what a VIP is in the gambling world. Can you enlighten us to what that is?
Well, it's a pretty ironic term. It means that you're a loser, essentially. You know, if you get into the habit of winning, you're liable to have your bets refused. On the other hand, if you hit what they call a predetermined net loss threshold, in other words, start losing money by the bucket load, then you're likely to be granted VIP status. So you are very important only in the sense that you represent a serious revenue stream to the gambling companies.
So do they woo you?
Well, what it means in practice is that you'll be incentivized to keep gambling with perks like free bets or free tickets to sporting events. And you're likely to be assigned a VIP manager, your kind of handler, who has discretion as to what perks he or she can tempt you with. So as Davis explains, the job of the manager is to identify what he calls the triggers that will induce a kind of gambling frenzy in the VIP. In other words, extract minimum value out of them. So if you're a football fan, your VIP manager might take you to a game. You might be taken out to dinner. If you're into gardening, your VIP manager might woo you with a pot plant. I mean, it's quite an intimate relationship, as Davis describes it. You know, they might take you out to dinner or to a West End show.
What a weird job to have, though.
Yeah, really
to
weird.
To be a VIP manager, really strange.
It's pretty strange. It's kind of insidious. I suppose it's akin to the kind of free drink and food you might get in a Las Vegas casino, but extended into your everyday life in, as I say, in a very intimate way, outside of the explicit gambling context, much as, you know, smartphone technology has allowed gambling to expand beyond the betting shop or racetrack into every little nook and cranny of your existence. It's a slightly creepily intimate, chummy relationship. And the trouble is that it's done indiscriminately. The only consideration is extracting maximum value out of you as a customer, regardless of your financial circumstances or mental health, your susceptibility to addiction, for instance.
And so if the gambler were to say to their VIP manager, look, I'm getting a bit worried about this, I'm beginning to struggle, I'm not sure I should be doing this anymore, that would just be sort of cut off and they'd say, sure, don't worry, let's have another drink or whatever.
Well, I'm not sure about that. I mean, strictly speaking, there are then protocols in place for the customer to exclude themselves. Although, as Davis reports, there are many instances where those guidelines have not been followed.
And you talk about the smartphones, because of course that makes it possible to gamble anywhere at any time.
Yeah,
it's a problem, isn't it? But why is it such a problem that the legislation hasn't kept up with the technology, which is basically online play?
Well, I mean, the key piece of legislation governing how gambling is regulated in the UK is the Gambling Act of 2005, introduced under the Blair government. And that was designed in a classic Blairite deregulatory fashion to remove curbs on gambling and make the UK this kind of shining centre of the gambling industry. So it was allowed, for instance, for the first time there to be TV ads for sports betting, as opposed to just the kind of pools, for instance, online casinos and poker. But the problem was the timing. This was 2005. And around that time, I don't even remember the big hoo-ha over super casinos, but that's what everyone was obsessed with. But the elephant in the room was the internet. And of course, the first generation iPhone comes out 2 years later in 2007. And so no one at the time the act passed into law knew how profoundly smartphones would transform our lives, or that within a few years, as you say, 24/7 access to this vast range of online casinos and betting exchanges would be available in everyone's pocket. So there was nothing in the legislation that could deal with the problems this would cause, in particular, the vast new marketing reach via social media and in-app advertising, etc., that would get around the regulatory framework attached just to TV advertising.
So that's just a straightforward, they were just being too old-fashioned, because they can say, well, you can't have lots of TV ads before the watershed, but you can have as many as you want inside apps and online and all that. Is it just as simple as that?
It's just a classic example of an analog law in a digital context, digital age.
Still kind of in the world of those of betting shops, I suppose, high street betting shops, which must have taken a bit of a tumble, really, if everybody's sitting at home doing complicated bets on all sorts of things. And we just kind of associate it with, you know, little pads and tiny pens and people just sort of hanging around and watching the, you know, the 3:30 from Kempton or whatever. And it's, of course, not like that at all anymore, is it?
No, I think David says it was by 2017, the take from web-based gambling had outstripped the combined take from high street betting shops. And casinos and racetracks. So yes, it's been completely transformed.
And tell us about these other things. There are various anachronisms like VIP, which obviously doesn't mean VIP in this context. What about the FOBTs? What are they and why are they important?
The dreaded FOBTs, yes. So FOBT stands for Fixed Odds Betting Terminal, and they were introduced, as I recall, in 1999. And they are electronic, Vegas-style electronic slot machines that offer a range of simulated games, but the most popular is roulette. And the problem, again, is in the potential for near-continuous play. So until the maximum allowable stake was reduced by law in April 2019, you could bet up to 100 quid every 20 seconds. So they are just bottomless pits of profit for the gambling companies.
And there's no curb. If I do it for 4 hours and I lose £20,000, there's nothing stopping me.
There were curbs introduced in, as I say, in 2019, where the maximum allowable stake was reduced to £2. But up until that point, no, there were very few curbs. And so by 2017, these things are accounting for more than half of the revenue earned by the UK's high street bookmakers. So, I mean, Davis cites a very interesting case, which is that the 2005 Act allowed for no more than four of these FOBTs per shop. And the industry's response was very simple: open more shops. So there's this planning loophole which classified gambling betting shops as financial institutions. And so the gambling companies are able to take over premises previously occupied by banks and building societies, which of course are deserting the high street in droves as internet banking takes off, particularly in more deprived areas. And they can do that without planning permission. So the result is what is known as clustering, operators opening multiple branches on the same street, often in those really poor areas. So, you know, you might go to Newham in East London, the 25th most deprived borough in the country, and there would be three branches of Paddy Power within a few yards of each other, because the profits from these machines were just staggering, vastly outstripping the retail space costs.
So it's just simply worth opening. It's a very worth opening shops to fit them in, basically. It's a very clever and pragmatic way around the kind of attempt at legislation, isn't it?
Absolutely. I mean, the industry has proved itself extremely canny in getting around these rather feeble regulatory efforts.
So if Davis is providing, I mean, that's just for the UK, isn't it? He's providing the legal and the social and the political background.
That's right.
And Patrick Foster, in his book, which is called Might yeah. Bite, The Secret Life of a Gambling Addict, that's the first-hand account, isn't it? Can you tell us about his trajectory, how he got into it?
Well, I mean, research has shown that problem gambling often starts with a big win. And this was the case with Patrick Foster. So he was a highly talented cricketer. He played first-class cricket for Durham University and North Hants. But clearly, and by his own admission, there was something a bit self-sabotaging in his nature, shall we say. So after a couple of years of patchy performances on the pitch and, incidentally, alcoholic ones off it, he's let go of by the club, eventually gets himself a job as a teacher at an independent boarding school in Oxford. But meanwhile, he develops a very serious gambling habit. And the critical point comes when he places an accumulator bet on six Champions League football matches. So, as you may know, if you win an ACCA, as they're informally known, all six of those results would have to go your way. And incredibly, they do. All six results go Foster's way, and he wins just short of £35,000. And so his story, like so many others in his shoes, is one of someone trying to chase the dopamine hit of that early win. He spends that 35 grand within 6 weeks. And with his smartphone to hand, he starts gambling during lessons and on school sports trips. He starts taking out the dreaded payday loans and funding the minimum repayments by borrowing from his friends and, more perilously for his career, from the wealthy parents of his pupils. So it's an incredibly tense, plate-spinning situation. Just when you think he can't get into more financial trouble, he does. But what emerges from it in particular is the weird abstraction of disordered gambling. It's just not about the sports anymore. It's like Sky Bet's slogan is, it matters more when there's money on it. A brilliantly evil slogan.
Yes, that's very uncloaked, isn't it?
Really. And it applies absolutely to Patrick Foster, who is a massive, you know, a talented sportsman and a massive sports fan, loved his football and cricket and horse racing, but he loses interest in those sports per se. It's just about betting, which is sort of further abstracted from its real world financial consequences. So at the climax of the book, I hope this is not too much of a spoiler, but he wins £58,000 on a series of horse races, but it's not enough to pay off even the most pressing of his debts. So he bets it all on a runner at the Cheltenham Gold Club, which furnishes the title. The horse is called Might Bite, aptly named, if highly fancied. And he stands to win 200 grand, which would be enough to pay off those most urgent debts. And guess what happens next?
Is that the plan, that he wants to pay off all of his debts with it and stop?
I think it's just the kind of climacteric. He reaches a point where the debts are so huge.
Yeah.
Many of them are beginning to become pretty urgent. And of course, he's run out of friends and pupil parents that he can sponge off. So, you know, he's just in a desperate, desperate situation. So, it's either win this or end his life, which he comes very close to doing.
Wow. Presumably, you get the impression that, say, by some extraordinary manipulation of the odds, he had won. Say something had happened, he'd been able to pay off all his debts. He probably would have just started gambling again, wouldn't he?
I think that's absolutely true. Yeah. Mm. And undoubtedly would have found himself in a similar situation pretty quickly. I mean, it's the cycle of win and loss becomes so frenetic by the climax of the book that you could imagine that within a fortnight he'd be in just as much trouble. So in a sense, the Might Bite losing saves his life in a sense by the skin of his teeth.
Lucy, we were being quite lighthearted, weren't we, about my own recent flutters.
Mm.
Because, of course, I don't feel addicted to it. I don't, I actually think, wow, I've got a bit of money. It's like free money. And it's always struck me that that's one of the things that people chase in gambling. It's that idea that somebody will give you some money that you haven't worked for, which, of course, is what happens to the very wealthy, the privileged, perhaps all the time, but it doesn't happen to most people. The vast majority of people have to work for every penny they get, and so it must be something like just wanting that moment of actually just getting some money. Does that feel like the sort of kernel of what fuels gambling addiction?
It does, but the sense you get, as I say, the sense you get from Foster is that actually the money ceases to mean very much either. It's just the abstracted hit of a win, and that £58,000 is just sort of a number. It doesn't it doesn't really represent the kind of salvation or potential ruination of him and his family. It's just this number, and actually what matters is the winning, detached from all of its causes and consequences.
I thought it was very interesting, and I didn't know this, that you say, as you say, Alex, we were joking about your win, but as you were saying, now the problems often start with a win.
Yeah,
it's not that you start by losing. It's you start with a win, and then you go, oh, I want that again. I want that feeling again.
Yeah, the high is so great, so sort of transformatively great, that you spend possibly the rest of your life chasing the similar feeling, which of course never comes.
There is a very brilliant film which you may both know, The Small World of Sammy Lee, which is a 60s film, black and white, and it's about Anthony Newley is Sammy Lee. Mm. And he just has a few hours and he's got to pay these debts off, and it's just the marvelous claustrophobic kind of race around Soho eluding these people who are after their money. Mm. And so we know, of course, that this has been with us forever, but it has a very modern face in these books, as you've been saying, Nat. It's a completely different thing, but I suppose the emotions, the fear must be the same.
I think that's true, yes. Of course, as I say, smartphone technology has allowed it to pervade our lives entirely, but the the kind of mechanics of addiction are the same as they've always been.
And it's interesting that you say in the book, Foster, he's at pains to present himself like a normal bloke.
Yeah.
That's kind of how he talks and how he writes. And the sense is that this could happen to anyone. He really does say, look, I was just like anyone. But it seems like there are almost two of them. You call him a kind of Mr. Hyde-alike. There's the normal bloke, and then there's the other one who he doesn't really acknowledge.
I mean, it has to be said, it's quite a sort of upper bourgeois sort of normality. He's the kind of bloke who's always on the beers and off to Chamonix for a skiing holiday. You know, he says, the cricket coaching courses he runs in the school holidays earn him good wedge.
Yeah.
But the gambling self, it's true, the gambling self he presents to the outside world is highly normalized. He likes a flutter, occasionally takes it too far, just as he occasionally drinks a few too many Stellas. But this excess is kind of culturally sanctioned. It's the flaw that makes him normal. But in the reality, he's in the grip of an addiction that's almost demonic. You know, I say he drinks risks like blood. He is perfectly prepared to destroy his relationships. He's got a very supportive girlfriend, very supportive parents, got a nice, he has nice career prospects, but just to chase the dopamine hit of a big win. And so, you know, there are points, little gaps in the prose occasionally, which open up a view on this Mr. Hyde, this spiral-eyed gambling addict who does not consider it fair, despite what he protests to have to pay back his debts, that he'd rather just put the money on the 340 at Doncaster.
How about DBC Pierre's book, which is called Big Snake, Little Snake, An Inquiry into Risk? That sounds like something kind of completely different again.
It's so different. It's completely potty and absolutely brilliant. I loved it. So ostensibly a non-fiction account of a spell Pierre spends in Trinidad, where he's trying to film an ad featuring a parrot or something. It's kept rather pleasingly vague, the precise circumstances. But crucially, he gets into, I hope I'm pronouncing this right, Playway, which is the Trinidadian National Lottery. So the book is called Big Snake, Little Snake. And the little snake of the title is a baby pit viper he finds on his doormat in Trinidad. Now, in Playway, each number is assigned a symbol, and the symbol for 27 is a little snake. So the coincidence is enough for Pierre to put $10 on 27, and it wins. So the book then becomes this somewhat esoteric investigation into risk. Now, his central thesis is that what he calls the foreground of visible risk, the odds of winning at Playway, for example, is merely the discernible fringe of a chaotic, as he says, background jungle of odds, cascades of risk and chance, which are traceable back to the origins of the universe. So, you know, his openness to risk is only consistent with the unlikeliness of life on Earth.
Right. That's quite a big prism.
It is quite a big prism. You know, this book is a slender volume. Let's see. It's 159 pages long, but it is pretty cosmic in its reach.
And you see, he's trying to sort of tune into chaos and trying to access, he calls it the world of vivid maths.
Yes.
This is, I mean, a polite name for it is magical thinking, isn't it? But that's sort of the point.
It is the point. It is unashamedly irrational, if not to say mystical, this book. But, you know, he does make something approaching a rational argument for his openness to risk. You know, so he conceives of, the book is set in Trinidad in all its lushness and biodiversity, and he calls this a place of vivid maths. And he points out that places like that, in his account, often have a rich lore of magic. So, for instance, figures from Trinidadian folklore like La Diablesse, which is this horrific cloven-footed seductress with a corpse's face hidden under her veil, they exist to help the locals contemplate what he calls the horrors of nature's maths. So kind of encoding the odds of sexual misadventure or disease in terms of sensory experience rather than statistics. So, and likewise, a belief in luck, he believes, in auguries like the little snake. Yeah, it may be a very human way to reach behind appearances and touch these mathematics of chance. So, you know, life is unfair, and it's unfair in a manner determined by odds that you can't calculate, because they're, as he says, bullied and spun by human actors or by conditions caused by their actions. Whereas to gamble in games of pure chance, like Playway or roulette, is to leave that unfairness behind and, as he says again, drive up to that crystalline idyll of maths. So it's kind of to find out whether you're lucky or not, to see if you're favoured, if you're lucky, if you're alive.
But except it isn't at all.
No, this is not. I don't really feel like I'm dabbling in vivid maths when I buy a scratch card. But maybe I am.
Yeah, well, certainly in Pierre's terms, you are. It's to find out how lucky you are.
It's sort of to do with surrendering yourself, then. Is that it? To the sort of, to chance?
Surrendering yourself to pure odds, not distorted by human action, you know, unless it's corrupt.
But that cannot be true. Because I'm sorry to be boring about this, but they're not pure odds because you've made the decision to buy the ticket.
Well, how much you earn is of course determined by how many people are contributing to the lottery. But whether or not number 27 comes up is pure, as long as the lottery is being conducted fairly. That is just pure chance.
Right, I see what you mean. Because in terms of his cosmic prism, buying a lottery ticket, that's not pure risk or pure maths or anything. That's a sociological thing if you decide to buy a lottery ticket. That's not touching the face of maths or whatever it is.
Well, in mathematical terms it is, because you are just exposed to pure odds, to pure chance.
Once you've bought it, but the fact that you've bought it is a human and sociological thing.
Well, that I admit is true, yes.
Lucy, you really don't sound like you've got much time for this theory. You sound a little bit like this stuff and nonsense.
He's sort of conceiving of it as sort of sticking your finger into the socket of chance, risking being shocked, but also checking to see whether you're alive or not. That's the way he conceives of risk in these circumstances.
Yes, and I was slightly playing devil's advocate, and I haven't read the book, and obviously he has to persuade of this. And I think the thing about seeing if you're alive or not is to see whether you get that jolt, isn't it?
Yeah, which Rob Davis, by his own admission, doesn't get. He's, you know, the dopamine hit of risk, he says, is alien to him, as I have to admit it is to me too, you know.
But clearly not to Pierre, but also in a way,
not to Pierre.
I can see the sense, not sense, he doesn't want sense, does he? I can see the appeal of his approach because there's nothing you can do about it. So you might as well endow it with symbols and your own meaning and just say, let's have a go, because so much of what's going on is not up to me. Why don't I throw this one in the air as well? And actually, it is quite a poetic way of looking at it. It's just that there's a lot of the underside of it, which is what we were talking about, which is not poetic at all. So I have a,
that's right.
Do you know what I mean? I have a bit of trouble squaring those approaches.
It's really interesting that he squares it, because we're thinking about his last book, which is a novel called Meanwhile in Dopamine City, was all about the sort of really the very seedy underside of things like social media. This idea that we are kind of being controlled through our machines and we don't realize what's happening to us, and human experience is being kind of reordered. Mm. And it's sort of very much against that kind of big business and algorithm and that controlling idea, which here he seems to see the good side in. So he's kind of himself having to square some things that aren't necessarily squareable.
I suppose so. I mean, it's possibly slightly difficult to conflate the algorithms of big tech with Trinidadian Playway, which is just a local little local numbers game. But yes, I mean, he is trying to square a circle to a certain extent, and he does so in this essentially mystical fashion.
That's perhaps a much more human way of approaching it than actually the very cold big tech approach of, okay, let's put in fixed odds betting terminals, let's make it available 24/7, let's get round everything so that people can do it whilst being almost completely divorced from the realities of what's happening, which is that they're losing thousands and thousands of pounds. So maybe, as I say, maybe it's much better to have your eyes open and go, don't know, anything could happen.
I mean, and thanks to the TLS for assigning me this task, these three books, because I do think that Pierre is, you know, potty as it is genuinely complementary to the other two, but you know, Davis is deeply researched. The Patrick Foster is a pretty sort of moving firsthand account of gambling addiction, but neither of them quite, well, I mean, who could delve into the attractions of gambling in the way that Pierre does? And I think it just provides a perspective that is of use to those trying to figure out how to address the problem of disordered gambling.
I must say, I'm, for some reason, my mind's gone off on a tangent and imagining Patrick Foster and DBC Pierre kind of sitting and discussing this, perhaps over a Stella, and the kind of idea of, you know, Patrick's sort of good wedge for cricketing and DBC Pierre's vivid maths. They seem completely, you can't imagine them talking to each other. They've got completely different experiences of the world.
Yeah, I mean, yes, it would be a really unexpected collision, but I think quite a
fun one.
Yeah.
That's partly what it's about, isn't it? I just think that unless you're a very good mathematician we're very bad at calculating risk.
Yes, I mean, notoriously so. I mean, you might become a professional poker player, and then there is a level of skill that can be applied. It is possible to beat the house in those instances, but otherwise, no. We're useless at it, and that is much to the gambling company's benefit.
So perhaps if we did have a takeaway, it's just let's be aware of how useless we are at thinking about risk.
Yeah, and bet on the Grand National once a year and then leave it at that.
Well, thank you very much, Nat Segnet, for talking to us today.
To come on the show, we'll delve into the world of Kay Dick's dystopian novel They, reissued 45 years after its first publication. And if you've enjoyed what we've discussed so far this week, let me remind you that you can subscribe to this podcast for free wherever you normally get your podcasts, and you'll never miss an episode. To the TLS podcast. I'm Alex Clark. Violent groups patrol the country, seeking out those guilty of crimes against the state, owning too many books, for example, or being single. Our nameless narrator keeps on the move, but can he stay ahead of the terrifying they? Kay Dick was a publisher, a writer of romance, an interviewer of contemporaries such as Stevie Smith and Ivy Compton Burnett, and the author of They, a slender dystopia that came out in 1977 and has now been reissued. Kevin Brazil has reviewed the novel and is here to tell us more. Welcome, Kevin. I believe you're joining us from Naples.
Yes, I am. I'm having a little holiday in Naples, and just had a little swim in the bay this morning, which is pretty much the opposite, I guess, mood of the dystopian novel we're going to talk about. But I have to just come from where I am, I suppose.
You know, Kevin, you are allowed to have a holiday. We will not accuse you of being one of the bourgeois who is kind of satirized in this novel. Just tell us a little bit more about it. Tell us about the novel and about Kay Dick herself.
So, I mean, yeah, as you kind of said, Kay Dick was a writer and an editor and a publisher. She was quite a trailblazer, really. At 26, she was the first woman director in English publishing at P.S. King & Son. And she was a journalist at the New Statesman, and she published five novels between 1949 and 1962. As you said, they were more kind of romances and not dystopian fiction like They. And she also published a couple of quite remarkable books of literary interviews, which are always kind of fun to read, with people like Ivy Compton Burnett, Stevie Smith, Olivia Manning, Maureen Duffy, you know. So she wasn't some kind of like forgotten or minor literary figure. If you kind of read some of the reminiscences that have been published when They has come out, you know, she's kind of at the center of this amazing network of experimental and queer and lesbian women writers. So it's really striking that when she published They in 1977, that it kind of, you know, dropped off the radar. I mean, it got some horribly misogynistic reviews. I have a quote from one. If I can read it out. One reviewer dismissed it as a fantasy sprouting from some collective menopausal spasm in the National.
Wow. Oh my goodness.
So, you know, wow. Yeah, that kind of says it all. And that was 1977. So, why it provoked such a strong reaction, other than standard misogyny, I don't really know, or homophobia. But anyway, it was forgotten. And then we have the literary agent Becky Brown and the critic Lucy Scholes to thank, because in 2000, I think, they both sort of came across a copy of it and republished it, I think, to pretty great acclaim. I mean, it's an incredible dystopian novel, I think, all the more powerful for being quite oblique. So if I might, will I just give it a description kind of what it's like
yes,
as a novel?
Yes, yeah. Please.
So it's very oblique and kind of restrained. You kind of open with this unnamed and also, I think, ungendered character. I don't think you ever discover how they refer to their own gender anyway, which is a kind of, I think, something that might loop back to K. Dick's own take on gender. I think she once called gender, you know, this silly thing of no bloody account. But anyway, so you have this narrator and they're kind of living by the coast down in Sussex and they're visiting their friends. And all of a sudden you just get this reference to the books have been stolen. You know, it's this kind of glancing thing. Oh, my copy of Dickens or whatever was stolen last night. And it's never really kind of like commented on by the characters in the novel. There seems to be a thing they're accepting. Then you get these little allusions to, oh, they've burned the books at Oxford and they've taken the paintings from the National Gallery. So as it kind of unspools, you know, this narrator, you kind of realize they're just kind of living down by the coast in the South Downs with all their friends and this kind of strange band called They, right? These people are always referred to as They, are kind of roaming the UK, burning books, defacing paintings, emptying museums. And as you slowly begin to realize, they're also kidnapping and torturing artists and writers who don't stop producing their work. So a lot of the narrator's friends are opera singers or poets or painters. And if they don't give up what they're doing, they're taken away, their hands are amputated, they're burned, they're locked up and or even killed. But what makes this kind of novel, I think, so fascinating to me is this sense that the narrator and their friends sort of accept what is going on. And then you can kind of see that as, on the one hand, trying to survive by just kind of withdrawing to their, you know, idyllic Sussex lifestyle while the world burns around them. Or you might wonder, is Dick trying to make us think, well, is there a certain level of, I don't know, complicity or should they be fighting back against what is happening? So I think, you know, in its like less than 100 pages, it just packs in so much stuff that is, you know, so much so relevant today, you know, with government being hostile towards the arts. I won't push that too far. But also, you know, when would you begin to fight back to defend, you know, culture or queer lifestyle or, you know, feminist ways of living? You know, it's a hard question that I think is kind of relevant today for unfortunate reasons, I suppose.
Is it any work that the artists or the singers or the writers produce? They just have to stop producing everything, or is there some of it that's okay? Is it about a particular slant or a type of work?
So, I mean, one of the strengths, I think, of this novel as a piece of dystopian fiction is that a lot of those questions are left kind of unanswered. You know, it's not one of those dystopias where the world building is kind of takes up pages and you learn what the government agency responsible for prosecuting this, that or other is called. Mm. Kind of have to imagine yourself. But I think on balance, it's as the novel unfolds, because it kind of takes place over a couple of weeks, you get the sense that it is creation and art in general that they are trying to attack. Now, the only thing that gives us a little bit of a twist, which is the kind of complicated but interesting thing to me, is that, you know, they don't have a problem, the people destroying everything, they don't have a problem with television or pop music or even, I think, reggae as it is more kind of mentioned specifically, because there's one scene where the narrator is, you know, strolling along the beach and she sees bands of, you know, people driving down from London within their horrible cars, and they want to stay in these horrible, you know, concrete hotels on the coast. And at one point she's like, they like to swim in swimming pools as opposed to the sea. How awful, you know, and you hear their music playing and their, you know, stupid lives watching television.
That's fascinating. So there is, as you point out in your review, there's a really kind of embedded sort of class sense in the book. And I just thinking of when I was introducing the book, I called the narrator he, and I absolutely assumed it was a man. And of course, I had no reason to do that, which in itself is kind of weird and interesting, isn't it?
Well, I would say it's interesting because even because I assumed it was a woman or someone who might identify as a woman. But when I went back and looked at it carefully, there was no reference to their gender that I could see. So I don't know why you thought it was a man and I thought it was a woman. But anyway,
I know. Well, there is a kind of strange fluidity to the book in all sorts of ways. But this class sense, I mean, you focus on this idea that the narrator is describing a very comfortable cultural world that also seems especially English. And you mentioned Virginia Woolf and Duncan Bell secluded in their beautiful gardens. I wondered how much you thought this was an unconscious reflection of privilege and how much it's a criticism that Dick herself was making.
I can't say whether it was conscious or unconscious. I think maybe from Dick's own life, you might think of her as someone who had, you know, a lot of, say, cultural capital, you know, living in Hampstead and working and publishing and knowing everybody worth knowing. But, you know, ended her life living in a basement flat in Brighton and selling off bits of her estate because she had no money. So it's kind of interesting like that. I think that the ambiguity is what makes it a more interesting novel for me, both in thinking about, you know, dystopia, but also for thinking about class and queerness. There is, as you said, this long kind of romanticized image of, you know, Virginia Woolf and Vita Sackville West and all these people at Garsington or Sissinghurst, you know, and making beautiful Omega Workshop furnishings, and all of that is beautiful. You know, I in the reopened Courtauld, they have a sort of Omega Workshop room with one of Duncan Bell's carpets, and it, you know, it's so beautiful and amazing, and you think you just might want to live that life. But, you know, it was, and for many people still is, a life just for the queer upper class. And if you kind of develop a sort of opposition, as seems to happen for the narrator, between, you know, culture, queerness, and an enlightened lifestyle on the other, and the working class and awful taste and, you know, destroying the environment on the other, what gets lost is the idea of queer working class people who, of course, cross that bridge, in addition to, you know, kind of being imagining that, you know, things like pop music aren't culture in themselves. So I think I would like to think it's intentional, because then it stops the novel being this kind of like, you know, we'd all love a story of, you know, whether you're committed to literature, as I imagine people on this podcast are, or queer people, you know, it's easy to think when the, you know, world starts to end, we would be only the victims and we'd never be complicit in anything. But I think by exploring complicity, it makes for a sort of more interesting take, I think.
Yes, you also make the point, don't you, that there's aside from these, there are individual acts of resistance in the book, but there is a kind of general passivity in the face of this, essentially what's totalitarianism.
Exactly, yeah. And I think it makes you think, and it has certainly made me think over the past couple of months, you know, what would I do, you know? And one of the things that has made this novel, I think speak to the moment, is one of the things I've been reading a lot is reflections by artists and theater directors and writers in Russia, you know, and this question of, you know, are they going to be the one who's going to speak out against the war and risk going to jail? Or, you know, are they going to just try and survive and get by? And you kind of think, I'd love to think that, you know, whether in the world of they or in our world right now, you know, I would be the one who would risk going to jail or getting my hand cut off to keep writing or protest against the government. But maybe I wouldn't, you know? Mm-hmm. And I think it's that that the novel explores, and that's really captivating, I think, for something so short to be able to do that.
It's really also interesting to think of it coming out in 1977 now as I would say the senior member of this particular bit of the podcast, and I say that in purely age terms. I remember this, it was the Silver Jubilee in 1977. At my school, we had to tape our rulers up, our wooden rulers, mark you, with coloured crepe paper and go and wave them at the Queen who drove past through our town. So there was this, and it was street parties. It was also the end of, well, coming to the end of the punk era. So it's really interesting to think of it coming out in that particular climate. And yet, as you say, Kevin, still pretty relevant to, well, another Jubilee year in England.
Well, yes. I mean, just what you said right there about having to carry your rulers with the crepe paper along the streets reminds me of one of my favourite scenes in the novel, which is when the narrator just comes across bands of they kind of spread out all over the hills in the South Downs, holding up these poles and just doing these kind of weird dance-like maneuvers, and it's never explained, you know, what they're doing. And so, I mean, I don't think it could be as so accurate as comparing street children holding rulers on the street to that bit in the scene, but that was just the funny thing.
There was a sense of sort of carnival, I suppose,
yes,
in the air. I guess it's something like that. It was possibly quite jingoistic sense of carnival.
Yeah, or the ways in which, you know, there's things that you might not want to get swept up in as an individual. You know, I'm not going to join this national festival because, I don't know, is it a bit jingoistic? But if everyone around you starts doing it and you're invited to join the parade or join the party, people do get swept up in a collective way. So that, I think, will probably start happening again over this Jubilee. We'll see.
Can I ask a question at the risk of stereotyping myself? Can I ask about gardens? Because it's really interesting to me about gardens and nature and sort of how they're seen. I mean, nature in inverted commas, because part of the privilege that you say of the people who are sort of, you know, the people who are secluding themselves, cutting themselves off, is that they have these beautiful gardens and they create them. And it's the idea of the garden as a kind of refuge from everywhere else. But there's also the idea, which is a very egalitarian idea, that the countryside is for everyone. And now the idea that the countryside and the planet is for everyone, if you take it as far as Extinction Rebellion, that's quite a radical idea. Does the countryside and the garden kind of feature in that way in the book?
Yeah, I think it features in both those ways, again, in that kind of characteristic ambiguity as it has, that the novel has. So on the one hand, you've got, you know, all these opera singers and poets and writers, you know, quite literally tending to their garden while the world burns. And, you know, they're these big kind of manor houses and country estates. But then, you know, one of the ways in which the narrator finds some kind of peace is when they go walking just in nature itself. So, you know, in forests and in hills or just along the beach. And, you know, the beach is kind of for everyone. That's kind of why it's such a utopian place. So I think it has both ideas of nature, you know, nature as the garden, which doesn't have to be exclusive, but sadly kind of has got some of that connotations, at least in the English class system, but also nature as the universal thing that is for everyone. Yeah, and I think it's just one of those ambiguities that makes it really fascinating.
I disappeared down a little bit of a rabbit hole finding out about Kay Dick. And she lived for many years with another novelist, Kathleen Farrell. And I discovered that they were part of something called the Lady Novelists Anti-Elizabeth League.
Okay, tell us more.
It was people not, you know, as we've been talking about the Jubilee, it wasn't an anti-monarchist thing. It was Elizabeth, the novelist Elizabeth Taylor. And it was a group of women novelists who were united in their dislike of Elizabeth Taylor, who of course is now one of those novelists who, again, you know, via the power of reissue, is enjoying this great kind of heyday. I mean, you know, people have loved her for many years, but she's being sort of rediscovered. But it was so interesting to me to think of these kind of factions in women's writing, and put together with what you were saying earlier, Kevin, about, you know, the hideous notion of the menopausal spasm of a review, it kind of creates this fascinating idea of a sort of territory of women's writing, which I know is one of the things that you know you're an expert on, aren't you?
Well, I love that, because one of the things that it does is by showing that, you know, boundary pushing women's writing in the mid 20th century in Britain. And I do think Elizabeth Taylor is boundary pushing in her own quiet way. You know, I kind of love the, I don't know, the kind of just the subtlety of the lies that you also get in other novelists. But that, you know, that her, that she's at war, her and maybe Anita Bruckner, you know, in one corner, are at war with like Kay Dick and Bridget Brophy and Maureen Duffy, and also people, you know, like Anne Quinn, whose Berg, you know, actually whose novel Berg, which is this very kind of experimental Brighton novel, one of the characters in They is called Berg, so I kind of think that must be a reference.
Yes.
Or someone like Christine Brooke Rose, you know, who wrote this amazing, another amazing forgotten dystopia, Out, which I don't think hasn't been republished at all, but is this kind of race reversal dystopia where Britain in the future, people who are quote unquote white are ruled by people who are quote unquote black. And I think that, you know, that there's so many of these novels that are still not republished, and that the scene was big enough, I suppose, to have feuds is actually a sign of how vibrant the scene was, you know? And I still, I think it's, yeah, still a little forgotten, although so many of those writers, unfairly so.
I mean, dystopian fiction, as you're kind of pointing out there, it's been with us for a long, long time. And at some level, it always tells you about what the anxieties and preoccupations of both the writer and audiences and the age are. And I was thinking of this because I've just read Sandra Newman's The Men, which is a novel about anybody with a Y chromosome disappearing in an instant. And it's been pretty controversial ahead of publication, because it essentially does divide the world into pretty kind of clear sort of gender binaries. And I wonder whether, I mean, what you think about this whole kind of territory in general, about what dystopian fiction tells us beyond that kind of, you know, anxiety about, you know, apocalypse. We think of it as just sort of apocalypse fiction, but it always seems much more subtle than that to me.
Yeah, I mean, I haven't read The Men. I've read many men, probably too many men. But I haven't read Sandra Newman's The Men, so I won't comment on that. But, you know, I mean, I think you're totally right to say dystopias, whether they're projected into the future or in alternative versions of the present, they're all about our anxieties now. And I think there's also kind of an interesting thing that we also read into dystopias what our anxieties are as readers. So we've got this novel published in 1977, which, as you say, could have come out of a very different moment, maybe, you know, 1970s decline. I mean, another work that it reminds me of just thinking of it is Derek Jarman's film, Jubilee. We've got this kind of dystopian version of Britain and, you know, everything's burning down and everything. But we're here now in 2022 and we're reading in things like, you know, the ecological collapse. We're reading in things like the war in Russia. We're reading in things like a certain government trying to bring down the BBC and cut, you know, cutting back culture in the UK. So I think it can be like a screen in which we see both the concerns of the writer at the time, but also readers across history.
Yes, definitely. As we've sort of mentioned, it's quite different. They is quite different from the rest of Kay Dick's work. I mean, should we read more of her, do you think? Should we read some of her other novels, be they ever so different?
Well, I think one should always read, you know, just you should never know.
You're not going to say no. No, don't.
That is very much the motto of this podcast.
You know, nothing wrong with an afternoon with a book and a cup of tea that maybe might have been the most lively afternoon in your life. I certainly want to go back and read the earlier ones, just to understand why there was such a change. I mean, there was such a gap, you know, her last of her first phase novels came out, I think, in 62, and then They came out in 77. So that is a bit of a gap. I think we should definitely read those anthologies of interviews with other women writers of the time. I think that would be some way, as you say, to get into, like, you know, the anti-Elizabeths and all these kind of you know, I think still overlooked writers. But the book of hers that I would like to read is her last book, actually, The Shelf, which I think came out in 82 or 84. Oh, I guess we can't fact check a podcast, but it was a couple of years later. And it's about a woman just kind of remembering an affair she had with a married woman, you know, maybe some 20 years ago. And I think just because, you know, I think I read a description, I think maybe in Lucy Scholes's profile of Kay Dick, about how it explores, you know, lesbian desire as actually quite damaging and destructive. And I think in that sense, perhaps all the more real. And it sounds like it has something in common with Day of exploring, yeah, of having just kind of, you know, putting ambiguities and ambivalences at the center of, you know, both the novel and queerness, and which I think is more fascinating, perhaps because it's more true, rather than simple kind of stories of everything is awful or everything is fantastic.
That is definitely one for the reading list. I have actually just managed to fact check this. It's 1984. Of course, another dystopian year, yes. Obviously. Down my rabbit hole, I was also reading about Kathleen Farrell, and I discovered that she was the author of a wonderfully titled book, Mistletoe Malice, which just sounds, I mean, who could pass up a book called Mistletoe Malice? So
that's one for Christmas.
It must be.
I'm putting that in for a family Christmas, you know, just to help me get through that, however bad. I've never felt Mistletoe Malice. Yet, I
mean, not yet. Kevin, you have mentioned her a couple of times, but we should also just say a big praise for Lucy Scholes, that she does so much of this really interesting work in these, you know, semi-forgotten, if not entirely forgotten, titles. I mean, we're very glad that she and the literary agent found this book, aren't we?
And Becky Brown as well. Who's an agent at Curtis Brown, I think. It's a great story in itself. I think both of them sort of came across it at the same time. I think Becky Brown just came across it in a Oxfam Books or something, and Lucy Scholes read an obituary and ordered up all the books from, I think, the London Library. And then they just sort of crossed paths and emailed each other being like, I've just discovered this novel and brought it out. So yeah, it just goes to show, you know, these amazing queer novels that completely speak to our present could just be gathered dust in some secondhand bookshop somewhere. So get searching, everyone.
Yes, exactly. We might put that out. We do occasionally set our listeners challenges, don't we, Lucy? And that will be one of them.
Just go and read a book. Go to a bookshop.
I'm afraid, Kevin, you've kind of set us the challenge. Go to Naples. I quite like to go to Naples. Are you reading a lot of Elena Ferrante while you're there, or am I just typecasting ridiculously?
No, I decided to lean in. I have Elena Ferrante's The Lying Life of Adults in my hand, actually, as we speak. But I'm also reading probably the opposite in tone, which is Curzio Malaparte's The Skin, which is set in Naples just after it was liberated by the Allies in 43 or 44. Mm. And that is it's set in real history, but that is a dystopian novel, let me tell you. So a lot of great Naples fiction to read, which I'm enjoying.
Well, have a wonderful time. And amongst the reading, don't forget to, you know, go to the gelateria. I mean, that's also important.
And the pizzeria.
Thank you so much for joining us. That was completely fascinating.
Thank you very much for having me.
That's all we have time for this week. Our thanks go to Nat Segnett and Kevin Brazil.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the TLS podcast, produced by Sophia Franklin.
We'll be back next week, but for now, from Lucy Dallas and from me, goodbye.